Well, we might as well get going. So, some of you had lab on Monday, right? Had to go. All right. Did you get muscle response, or what were you?
It was
the heart. Yeah. And it was beating okay.
Yeah, it was good. Okay.
Did you put epinephrine on or acetylcholine?
Yep.
You split up the group, or did you?
Each group did both treatments.
Both treatments. You had time to do both treatments,
yeah.
And both of them worked.
It worked really well. Our flexible was really great.
Okay, perfect. All right. So, if you, for Wednesday's group, I mean, Monday's labs met, and they liked it, supposedly, right? The heart lab, frog heart lab, pretty cool, very similar to how our heart works, and the pharmacology works, right? So, you're going to be putting epinephrine on the heart, as well as acetylcholine, right? And maybe next year we'll use some other agonist or antagonist, so it varies. But we're not into the heart yet, so in our chapters, so we'll hopefully get there soon. But really neat stuff. Okay, some other things to think about, because the times are coming up for some of these summer programs. And so you might want to, I just Googled, you know, REU, it's called Research Undergraduate Programs on NSF. So you write NSF, National Science Foundation, REU. And these summer programs, as I said, a lot of them will pay you while you're there. Some of them you just have to pay to get there, and some of it you might have to be out a little bit. But look at the opportunities you have. There's a lot of different programs here. Ecology programs, raptor research, you know, big birds, right? And science for society, educational programs, lots of different programs, gene expression effects. So you apply to these programs. Look, this one's over in Boston in the summer. That should be fun. And lots of neat places to try. So that might be something that you want to look at. That could be interesting. But what we're going to try to do today is to finish off the behavior chapter or content, and then go through some activities that we're going to have in class, and then hopefully take a quiz, right? And it covers all the information, and you're going to make 100 on the quiz, right? Yes. And if you haven't uploaded yet your news article, please do. Remember, just kind of follow what we had on that list about what you need to put in that news article, you know, why you chose that, why it's interesting for you, and then go ahead and put that up on there. As far as I know, everybody so far that's been uploading has done a good job with it, so it's good. It's supposed to kind of motivate you to look up content that you're interested in. Okay, for you that were here on Thursday last week, we had a leech up here for you to play with, right? That was kind of cool, and they're needing feeding, so if anybody does want to volunteer, it's okay. But the other animal that we're mentioning here that was really important for neurobiology is the aplasia system. And if you look at the scale bar here, look at 500 microns. What is that? That's a half a millimeter, right? Half a millimeter is the size of that cell. It is gigantic, right, for a neuron. And what they could actually do with the aplasia system is take out an individual neuron and run it on a Western blot. You could actually run it on an SDS page gel and isolate the different proteins in a single cell. That's pretty amazing, right? And then you could see it, you do some activity or some kind of change to the system, did the protein expression change? And here you're working with a single cell, but not only that, it's an identified neuron. So that's really important. Try to identify a neuron in a mammalian system. Try to go into the brain or the dorsal root ganglion and say, that neuron is number 15, and I'm going to go find it in my next rodent model or the next human model. You can't do that. So the power of invertebrates, for example, is that the nervous system is relatively simple and a few number of neurons that are usually identifiable from preparation to preparation to preparation. So it keeps down your variability, right? So pretty neat to think about. The aplasia system was really an amazing system, kind of like what we demoed on Thursday with the crayfish. Remember the tail flip? Right? We touch the tail flip, touch it again, tail flip. You keep doing it, it stops after a while. Habituation, right? And then people worked out the neural circuitry for that and got down to the mechanism of what's different in that neural circuitry. It's actually the synapses change. That's pretty amazing. And then we mentioned that if you take the large crayfish or lobster and you hit it on the tail, it doesn't tail flip any, really. Just like one time it might tail flip and then it wants to really bite you. So why is it different with age? But if we take off the claws, you know, pinch the claws and let them autonomize, all of a sudden it starts tail flipping again. How does it know that, right? So some really interesting aspects with simple systems to look at. The aplysia, Eric Kandel started off with that. I mentioned his name before he got the Nobel Prize, right? The clinical psychiatrist that actually worked on this preparation for a long time to understanding learning and memory and trying to understand it in neural circuitry, and then related a lot of that to higher animals, mammalian systems as well, which is very similar to the way our brain functions. But what he looked at is he actually looked at some of this neural circuit, and as I mentioned, I think before, he touched the siphon on this animal, that's the leech, the siphon, which is a little structure that comes out of the aplysia, and touches it, and it would retract, right? And then he kept doing that, and it would habituate too, but he could sensitize that animal by electrically shocking it and then touching the siphon, and it wouldn't habituate so quickly. It would always keep retracting. Anyways, he tried to recapitulate that by taking these neurons out that would fire and actually put it in a culture dish and redevelop that whole neural circuit. And so it was really quite powerful, just to give you an appreciation of why people use invertebrate models to understand higher systems, is that you can have a reductionist approach to really identifying key elements. So there's a lot to the system. A lot of people work on aplysia still. A lot of med school researchers at various medical schools actually still work with aplysia to try to understand a lot of aspects with this system. But we had to move on to, yes, this wonderful animal. We could have a whole course in this, but we'll have to, you know, content with going on. So you've worked with this system already, right? And we've talked about the tail flip and how that tail flip, that neural circuit works in the tail flip. Also, we demoed on Thursday, if you touch it in the head region, it'll tail flip backwards. Whereas if you hit it here, it will tail flip and go forwards so it can escape from predation, you know, whatever it experiences. Something else that's very interesting in these animals, this sphygmoidal ganglion right here, it has photoreceptors in there. That's kind of weird, isn't it? Why do you think it might have photoreceptors in the sphygmoidal ganglion? It's got a cuticle on top, too. Isn't that odd? I mean, think about the crayfish, you know. You ever look at little kids that hide behind the sofa or something, and they put their hands over their eyes and you can't see me, right? Well, the rest of the body's out there exposed. Y'all are sleepy. Okay. So, what can you imagine? Head's under a rock, right? But it wants to know if its tail's exposed, right? So the light that's shining on it, then it knows if, you know, light's on it, well, a predator can probably see it too, right? So they call it photoreceptors. And it's kind of an interesting situation because it's actually an interneuron from the sensory neurons, the primary sensory neurons that are tactile here. They project to an interneuron. That interneuron is what contains the photoreceptors, and that interneuron then goes on to other neurons. So it's kind of a dual purpose. It's quite interesting. Well, we've looked at cave crayfish in Kentucky. Anybody ever go caving, Mammoth Cave? No? Yes, some people have. Good experience while you're in Kentucky. Usually people, wherever they live, they don't go see the things that are right around them, right? But if you're, hey, spring break's coming up, what a great time, go to Mount Cave. There you go, next week. But we've gone down to Somerset, Kentucky. There's a cave system down there, Sloan's Valley Cave System. It's a 23.5-mile cave. You can get lost. There's no lights. You have to carry your lights. Crawl through the mud. It's really quite fun. But the cave crayfish actually have caudal photoreceptors, too. That's kind of neat. So what would you think? If they get out into the stream, wow, they're going to be history. And why they're going to be history is because they don't have any eyes. They're actually blind. We've actually looked at the omatidia structure. They don't have any omatidia. The central processing in the CNS is absent. So that's pretty neat. So they can't see their predators, but they can sense light, and they still have that caudal photoreceptor. Just things to think about that are kind of neat. But a segmental animal, just like the leech, right? And it's much like our spinal cord, too. We're segmental, you know, in the way that we developed as well. And there's a lot that we can get into, but we have to keep going. That little brain, though, can do so much. Just like in a fruit fly, you know, smell, find a mate, reproduce, get the right food, avoid the wrong food. That's pretty amazing, too. right? So if they put them on some food that has a contamination like bacteria, they won't lay eggs on it. I mean, they know, right? That's pretty neat. And where if you put some eggs on a particular dish, the mother that comes will lay eggs next to that, those eggs. So there's a lot even the simple little brains can do. So to kind of appreciate. So segmental animals, you know, they're really quite neat because you can understand how that segment works, much like us. Usually this kind of decentralized brain function because they can have these reflexes within. But then these larger brains where you start to get, you know, higher structures, like we're going to, well, like we saw when we went to the lab and we saw the human brain, you know, the cephalization, the cephalic development. And these are mostly in higher mollusk, you know, actually octopus are pretty smart, right? You've probably seen those PBS shows, what they can do and everything. And vertebrates, right? But these ganglion are generally come together and form a group of cells in the higher animals. And we call those, it's confusing sometimes, you might call that a nucleus, right? A nucleus of cells, it's not the individual cell nuclei, but a group of cells. So something to kind of think about. And so here's your generalization of advancing the brain. You see a simple segmental animal like a flatworm, earthworm, or leech, right? Crayfish, grasshopper starts to get these little ganglion together for each of these segments and the nerve roots. And then you see, like the aplysia is somewhat like this as well. There's these big groups of ganglion around with cells that control a region, and you can see the satellite ganglion controlling out in this region. And then when you go to higher animals, like we're going to see with the vertebrate, those ganglion are groups for those particular regions. Now, we've covered this before, right? The cross-section of a spinal cord of yours, for example, and that the sensory input comes in, right? The dorsal root ganglion projects in the dorsal horn, you know, it's a butterfly up there. This has appeared on standardized exams, your MCATs and DTAS and pharmacy exams. To understand basic anatomy. And so then it projects on, it could project onto the, right onto the motor neuron, and that could be a monosynaptic reflex, right? You've done that knee hit, right? Where you kick out. The speed of that is a monosynaptic reflex. So sensory neurons just come in, project onto this motor neuron, and then it will activate those muscles that you kick out. So that's kind of neat, but at the same time, there's lots of other connections in here too. So it's not, this is that reflex that you could have even if you were desebrate, but there's a lot of other connections that go contralateral to control balance, for example. But that knee reflex is much like what we've talked about. Let's try the demo with the vibrator on the arm, which didn't work so great. But I think what the problem was, I was too close to the elbow. I did it again with some kids before. We were actually a little ways from the elbow is better, and it works. I should have brought it back, and we could demo again. Have more victims to do that. Thanks. But that muscle spindle is what you're actually hitting when you hit that knee response. You're actually stretching that tendon, stretching that muscle spindle. It goes into the dorsal horn and then activates the alpha motor neurons. Those are those big motor neurons, right? Alpha motor neurons. To then give that reflex. Okay. In our spinal cord, it's so cool. This is that motor neuron. Remember two groups of motor neurons we should try to remember? Alpha motor neurons and gamma motor neurons. Anybody remember what gamma motor neurons are? Gamma motor neurons? Does that ring a bell? Talk about it. Gamma motor neurons. Alpha motor neurons. Let's go back to this. Remember that muscle spindle, that little MRO that's in your muscles, that little crayfish back muscle receptor organ? Remember those two muscle fibers, the nuclear chain, nuclear bag, it has sensory neurons around it. You stretch it, one's dynamic sensitive, one's static sensitive. And you have the same thing in your muscle spindles, right? But those are muscles too, just like in the crayfish MRO. The innervation for those muscle spindles, motor neurons, are called gamma motor neurons. All right, so they monitor that proprioceptive input for you. And it's really neat. If you're going on to med school or dental school or some advanced anatomy course, they'll actually maybe, you know, give you cross-sections of a spinal cord, and you have to guess where that is. But the gamma motor neurons have a little cell bodies in here, and you'll see those They're much smaller than the alpha motor neurons, but they then innervate the muscle spindle, muscle fibers. Okay. So what's really interesting about the alpha motor neurons, the ones that control your main muscle, your extrafusal muscles, the ones that give you the force, is that that's a motor neuron, but it innervates two different targets. It innervates not only your muscle, but it also innervates a neuron. Now, that's kind of weird, right? Because mostly you always hear about a neuron to a neuron or a nerve to a muscle. But rarely do you actually hear about these or study these, that these alpha motor neurons not only innervate the muscle, but they also innervate in the spinal cord a neuron. So they're innervating two different types of targets. One, a muscle far away maybe from the cell body, right? Think of the cell body in your spinal cord up here innervating the muscles in your big toe. That's a long motor nerve, right? But in your spinal cord, there's this little collateral that comes off and it goes to a Renshaw cell. And that Renshaw cell feeds back on the alpha motor neuron. And it's quite an interesting little circuit because it actually releases glycine as a neurotransmitter. So it's glycinergic. And it inhibits the alpha motor neuron. So it's like a feedback mechanism. And I pulled up a little diagram that I think will help you. Let's see if I can find it here. Yep. So this diagram is pretty neat because it has everything in it. Here's your alpha motor neuron going out to the muscle fiber. Here's your gamma motor neurons going to your muscle spindles. And then you see this alpha motor neuron having this collateral over to the Renshaw cell, and that Renshaw cell coming back and actually inhibiting the alpha motor neuron. That's pretty neat, a little circuit there. And it's, why might you think you would need a feedback mechanism like that? Any idea? And it's also kind of odd, it doesn't go to all of your alpha motor neurons. It's only subsets of motor neurons it goes to. Isn't that weird? It's kind of weird, right? So maybe some kind of feedback, right? So it's thought that the activity of the Renshaw cell only works to kind of suppress, if your alpha motor neuron's not super active, it will kind of suppress the ones that aren't too active, but allows your main alpha motor neurons to be really going to the target. So what it does is it keeps away maybe other muscle fibers from being active when you want to really hit the main ones that you're recruiting, right? So it's kind of like cleaning it up, if you will, you know, making it more prominent. Where does that kind of remind you of something that we've talked about before? Maybe with vision?
Lateral inhibition.
Lateral inhibition, right? So you can have very good edge contrast. Well, here's another kind of system to give good motor coordination for the muscles that you really want to activate and maybe suppress the others that aren't as active. And it's kind of an interesting system to look at. We don't get too involved, but it's unique in the sense of having a neuron innervate a muscle fiber as well as a neuron, right? And then having glycine at the Renshaw cell that actually innervates, then puts the suppression back on the alpha motor neuron. So there's so many odd things in science, right? And that's one of them that's pretty neat. Pretty cool. And then you can think of, I mean, you see multiple innervations over to this Renshaw cell and the activity. And some people have studied this in the cat spinal cord, dog spinal cord, rodent spinal cord. And if you look it up on the Wikipedia, you'll find out there's differences for the distal muscle fibers versus more proximal muscle fibers like in your upper arm or leg. So they're still looking at this and trying to understand why some systems have it more than others. And not all animals, and not all vertebrates also. So pretty neat. I love this slide because there's so much to it. And what's ethology again? Ethology? Back to your ecology class.
Animals in their natural environment.
Uh-huh. Study of animal behavior in their natural environment, right? So ethology, there's so much to this to try to understand the neuroethology, you know, controlling the behavior of the brain. And there's a lot to this. There's so much. You know, is it chemical cues? Is it sensory? Is it innate or is it learned? You know, what's going on with innate behaviors? How is that coded? I think I sent you, if you haven't put me on spam blog, the new ideas of the microtubule. Did I send that to you? Yes. Isn't that wild? This guy comes up with these new ideas about memory being in microtubules. And he actually then, some people think he's kind of crazy, And others are beginning to wonder if they put electrical current on these cells and they look at activity, the microtubules actually change. So maybe there is something to it. Remember, a lot of people that were kind of noted as crazy before have proven right and won Nobel Prizes, right? Like the guy with the bacteria in your stomach that, you know, described that basically just give antibiotics and you didn't need the anti-anxiety meds to control many ulcers. But so many different behaviors in the brain. So the take-home point here, too, is you can actually put an electrode into a cat's brain, for example, or a dog's brain, and you can stimulate a particular area, and they will show aggressive responses. They will attack what's ever in front of them. So that's pretty amazing to think about, right? So then you wonder, what about people? Do some people more aggressive because those areas are activated? Could we give them medications to suppress those areas? Do you want to do like the long time ago? And it's probably one of the most contested Nobel Prizes, and that was with the frontal lobotomies, right? They put an ice pick up basically above your eyeball and went across your frontal cortex and kind of scraped off your brain, cut the front part of your brain away. He got the Nobel Prize. A lot of people said that wasn't a good idea. But it basically, he took criminals, hardened criminals, and they did that with them. And they basically were not that active anymore. But they're pretty much a vegetative state. But, you know, that was crazy stuff a long time ago. Now, different therapies. But you kind of get the idea is that there's regions in the brain that control certain behaviors. That's the take home here, right? So you can put an electrode in that part of the brain, stimulate it, and they'll be aggressive or submissive or, you know, do different behaviors. There's such behaviors even down to the very simple organisms. Like there's Drosophila, forms of fruit fly larvae, the maggot, right? The maggot, that when this wasp, parasitic wasp, comes and they can actually inject with their ovipositor eggs inside of larvae, right? You might have heard that in other classes. But they find out, well, what happens when that larvae is being attacked? It will start rolling behavior. It starts to roll. Well, they wondered, how did it know to start to roll, right? Because you can touch it and sometimes it doesn't roll. But they found that it can sense the frequency of the wing beat of the wasp. So last year, a paper came out where they were measured the wing frequencies of these wasps and the animal that it correlates with, and they would just give that frequency, that sound frequency, to the larvae, and it would start to roll. So the idea is that they detect that wing frequency and then initiate that behavior so the animal can't land and put a, you know, egg inside of it, the animal, and kill it. So pretty amazing. Do you remember in ecology some of those people, right, with ethology? Conrad Lorenz, Nicky Tinbergen for the bees, Conrad Lorenz with this sickleback fish and gray lag geese imprinting, and then Nicky Tinbergen with the digger wasp. Here's another kind of interesting behavior. These are fiddler crabs, and that big claw that's on the fiddler crab, some fiddler crabs, and then a minor claw. It can't really eat with it. It's so big, it's not really useful. But what is it for? Pardon? Fighting, maybe fighting, like pushing away. But also?
Decoration.
Pardon?
Decoration.
Decoration for what?
Mating.
Mating, right. So it's actually a mating cue. And if you put fiddler crabs next to each other, and female fiddler crabs with the male fiddler crabs, the female won't pay attention to ones with small chelipeds. But it'll only pay attention to the big one. And he starts waving it like this, like, come on over here, you know. And so, and they've actually found out if they make it enlarged, it's actually more attractive to the female. You can go with that whenever you want. But it's kind of interesting in the sense that, too, if you cut off this claw, and it'll autotomize, right? It autotomizes. What happens with the animal's development? This one becomes the major claw, and it regenerates a minor claw. Is that not weird? But if you actually look in the brain of the animal, and you look at one side compared to the other, this side has more sensory neurons that comes in, and so that part of the lobe is extended. It's actually larger on that side and smaller on this side. But when you cut that off, that side regresses, and then this side starts to enhance. New sensory neurons start to come in an intact nervous system. So that's pretty amazing to think about. And then you can go back and take that one off after it's regenerated. Then the other minor will become the major, and it switches back and forth. So the idea is that it's plastic. It has neuroplasticity as an adult animal. How about our brain? How plastic is it as an adult animal? Not very, right? So the younger you are, the better it is. Maybe we should start you know, elementary kids in college, right? So they can learn better, maybe. Who knows? So stickleback fish, we're really big into cues as well, because it depended on how that cue was actually presented to them. That and it was a bigger cue, bigger contrast actually gave them the response, versus if it was in the wrong orientation, they didn't get the cue right for the other partner, for example. So people have done a lot of these neat behavioral projects with different animals to look at innate behaviors that are hardwired, pretty much, right? And then others that could be plastic, in the sense of, like, the claw. And how does it know to now only wave the big claw and not the minor claw, right? And then when it switches, now it waves the other side. So how does it relate that with the whole behavior and survival? Pretty amazing creatures. And then you think about the hard wiring, right? If you change your sensory neurons to go across the spinal cord to other motor neurons, you're going to have the alternate behavior. You don't have that plasticity. So the take-home here is that some parts of your brain are hardwired. When you're developing, you have a lot of plasticity, and you can, you know, alter how that might be connected. In some animals, they maintain that plasticity throughout their adult life. But many animals don't, especially higher animals. Pretty neat to think about when you can pinch a spinal, basically the ventral nerve cord or equivalent of a spinal cord in the leech, and watch it completely regenerate and get to the right targets, like a fish, some fish, and some lampreys, like Jeremiah Smith's working on upstairs in biology, too. It's pretty amazing. Or regenerate a whole limb and make those connections go into the right spot. Okay, we talked about omatidia. I just had this in there to kind of put it all together, about lateral inhibition and the retina. And we talked about wiring of the retina, right, crossing over. But this animal is quite amazing because in the amphibian, the eyes are to the side, not like in us. So they have a complete crossover. Isn't that kind of interesting? Complete crossover. So when it projects to the brain, higher system, it'll have that left hemisphere, left visual field going to the right side and the right going to the left with a complete crossover of the optic chiasm. But because we have eyes in the front of our head, we have a kind of a half crossover of the optic chiasm. But still, the right visual field's over here in the left hemisphere. The left visual field's over here in the right hemisphere. It's kind of neat. But in other animals that have eyes to the side, they still have it, but they have a complete crossover. That's pretty kind of neat to think about. But that general architecture of having the left hemisphere, you know, for on the right side of the brain and vice versa is pretty neat, held all the way through from amphibians to higher animals. You could spend the whole time just going through the circuitry here, but this is pretty neat. These projections that go to this, and like I said, a nucleus here is a group of cells, right? Not just a single cell. People get confused on that in tests, so don't get confused. This projections, actually from the left eye and the right eye, they compete for space in here. So they compete for that that target. So in here, there's synapses, right? Synapses. And then second order neurons go out. So there's connections here. But how do they know which connections to make? So it's really neat. We've talked about the eye in general, right? That it was rods and cones up there, intermediate ones, like a little nervous system right in the retina, bipolar cells, ganglion cells that then go out and make up that optic nerve, and they're going to go to that lateral geniculate. You don't have to memorize this stuff, okay? Because it's too much. But I just want you to understand, when we talked about these cells hyperpolarizing, right, with activity, then there's less neural activity to the bipolar cells. But because of this lateral inhibition and communication from amacrine and horizontal cells, it can change the activity of these ganglion cells. When people record from these ganglion cells, they know that there's different ones that respond differently to the visual field. Just so you heard of it, but I'm not going to test you on the details of this because it's too much. There are some of these ganglion cells that respond to a spot in the center and others that will inhibit when they have a ring around it like that because of lateral inhibition. So the output of the ganglion cells to the lateral geniculate picks up whatever that visual field is. So people call these cells, you know, on cells and off cells, our surround cells, but we're not going to get into the details of it, but I just want you to at least recognize it or hear of it in case you ever see it on some exam sometime, but not in this class. So you got on-center cells, off-center cells, and so this is what I mean by that neural network that's in your retina. Really quite amazing. Alright, and this is how we see in our area around us all the time. So it's pretty neat to think about. Now here's that lateral geniculate that I was telling you about. There's actually competition, as you can see, look at there. There's right eye, right eye, left eye, right? So the neurons are coming in and they're competing to make these synapses there. And this is pretty neat because how do they know to line up right? So if you, in, Torsten Wiesel and Ugel actually worked on this in monkeys and in cats. And in cats, you know, the kitten's born with its eyelids closed, right? And the monkey, they have their eyes open. But they did these phenomenal experiments, and we have to appreciate what they did at that time. They could actually go into the cat as soon as it's born and sew the eyelid closed. Or they could actually do ablation. Or put a patch on the eye. All kinds of things like this. And the monkeys, they did phenomenal experiments, very challenging. They could actually open up the mother, sew the eyelid closed of the developing monkey, and then actually go back to having a normal delivery, and then it would never see light, maybe in the right eye. Why was this important for their work on the kittens and monkeys? Because they looked at this developmental pattern of competition to the eye, to the like lateral geniculate. The take-home of this is that it was activity-dependent process to compete for that sight. And after, so if you close the eye, then there's no activity going this direction, right? So this side, the left side, will take over that neural space because it's activity dependent. But if you gave the eye back, like undid the sutures, right, or took the patch off, then this eye is getting the activity. And now it's trying to compete for these connections in the lateral geniculate. And it can actually do that. It can start to regain activity, especially if you put a patch over the other eye now and decrease this activity. But at a certain developmental age, like in mammals, that quits happening. So what's that referred to? Does anybody remember from another class? In neural development, when the system is becoming hardwired and you lose that plasticity, the second word is a period.
Critical period.
Critical period, right. So this is the critical period for development of the visual system. In different animals, people have looked at that. And so that critical period is when it's no longer so plastic, but early on it is. So why was this so important for Ugel and Wiesel that got the Nobel Prize? They both worked at Harvard, and they both worked under Stephen Kuffler. You don't have to memorize his name, but Stephen Kuffler was that guy I told you about, presynaptic inhibition and the crayfish, did so many things. He actually gave this project to Ugel and Wiesel, said, I think this is a pretty neat project to work on. And then they went on, worked on, got the Nobel Prize. Stephen Kuffler gave out probably four or five different projects. I think four of those people got Nobel Prizes from his work in his lab. That's an amazing guy. So this worked out to understand then humans. In humans, we have a number of people, it's nothing to be ashamed of or anything, but where you call it a lazy eye, where one eye might not focus exactly on, you know, the same focus. When you're born as a baby, your eyes don't really focus, but at a certain time, they should focus and they should follow, like, your finger moving. This is what the pediatrician looks at for developmental periods, right, that you should have. Well, it used to be that people would say, well, don't do any surgery on the eye until the person's a teenager or maybe a little bit older to be able to handle the surgery, where they could actually shorten the muscles on the eye. You have like these six different groups of muscles on your eye, which are really amazing. But they could shorten them so you could actually have the two eyes together and you could focus. The difference with some people, what they call a lazy eye, is that it's hard for spatial depth, where you can't maybe see, you know, something spatially, the distance, if you have the lazy eye. So they would do these surgeries to help correct it. But it didn't change. They still couldn't have the spatial resolution that they wanted because it's past the critical period. So now, if it's a really severe lazy eye, where the eye is really off to the side, they'll go and do that surgery as soon as they can, early on. So it changed the way ophthalmologists, you know, surgery was changed in humans to correct this problem. So then they could have spatial depth later on. They used to not allow pilots to fly if they had a lazy eye because they thought they couldn't hit the runway, right? Because they didn't have spatial resolution. But then people actually did the research and found that it didn't matter because the speed you're traveling, it doesn't matter to hit the runway with that spatial depth. So now they've even changed the rules for pilots with a lazy eye. You can be a pilot with a lazy eye now. But it's because of research. The point is research, you change ideas, right? So the take home here is that that earlier work won a Nobel Prize for looking at developmental regulation of how your nerves compete for the target cell. Just like your skeletal muscle, you have multiple motor neurons to your skeletal muscle in development, but one wins out, right? So in an individual muscle fiber in your body, skeletal muscle, you only have one motor neuron that innervates that extrafusal muscle, right? And it competes early on. Now, there is something very unusual. I mentioned, I think, before, other muscles in your body that actually have two types or maybe even three motor neurons to it. Remember which muscle that was? It's very unusual. Don't get confused on MCAT tests because they usually don't talk about that, so you don't, you know, use that as your right answer. But the eye muscles can actually have multiple motor neurons innervating the same eye muscle. Isn't that odd? That's really neat to think about, right? So it's really quite neat. And it's thought because of the cycads and the way you move your eyes. And it comes from a different embryological origin. Your other muscles, your skeletal muscles, come from somites. These somites, that's why it's called a somatic nervous system, is the somites develop as you develop from your segments. And they go around and they make segments in your body. They make the skeletal muscles in your segments. And your sensory neurons and motor neurons go with those. So anybody has ever saw somebody with shingles, right? It could be one pattern, a blotchy pattern, a band, because that nerve that goes to that patch of skin is inflamed and it makes a rash in a stripe-like pattern. That's pretty neat. It's because it's segmental. And it stops right at the midline, which is really amazing, too. Okay, so it's pretty neat to think about. If you ever get a chance to take an embryology course, developmental course, I'd go for it. It's really neat to think about. So this is the kind of work that Yubel and Wiesel did. Really quite important because of understanding the plasticity of the nervous system. They would give them different visual spots and see what kind of neurons fired and all these good things. And they actually found out in the occipital cortex, mapped out the brain, and just like in you, in the back of your head, the occipital cortex is where you integrate visual signals. And not only that, but you know it's moving left or right or up and down or what kind of signal it is. And they could record it from these cells in the occipital cortex and find out they would respond best to light in particular regions. Another neuron might respond best to that visual field up there, like that. So you actually respond best for these occipital neurons after integration to lines. So that actually helps you with the edge contrast again, right? So it's kind of neat. All right, so the idea is that these neurons, a row of them, will respond all the same way. And if you go deeper in the brain, not just the surface layers, but you go to the next layer deeper, those are the ones that respond to the movement of the line. So that's pretty neat. So the movement of the line is a deeper layer, more integration. The ones on the surface are just respond to the bars, and the ones below then respond to which direction you're moving. Well, when people did that on the cortex or your sensory perception, like touch on your cortex in the region, they found the same thing. The first neurons on the surface respond to the touch, where it is on your body. The neurons that are deeper respond to which way your movements are on your skin. So it's kind of neat. It's the same kind of arrangement as you go deeper in the system. So we'll stop with that stuff. These are just ways to stain up neurons. They would use activity-dependent dyes or radioactive glucose, for example, and they could actually see which neurons are active when you give them a particular visual pattern. That pattern would be replicated on the cells in their occipital cortex, like which cells are lined up, and see that same pattern. Isn't that, that's pretty cool. So this is how they worked all that out. There's a stimulus, there's the pattern on the occipital cortex. See which neurons are active. Amazing stuff that they did a long time ago. Now we can do it mostly with other imaging, live imaging, but this started all that process. We talked about the ear and owls before in that lab that we went over to in the outreach center. Again, the left and right ear, millisecond differences they can detect from left to right. Amazing. And here's just a simple animal behavior, much like the tail flip. These are little sea-like animals that you can touch and then watch the tail flip, and people have worked out that whole behavior that they have, an innate behavior that's in that circuit. You wonder, how do innate behaviors come about, right? Just amazing that the wiring is
there to give that particular behavior. If it didn't have it, their history, right? So there's selective pressure for that behavior to go on. There's our beautiful thing. We just stare at it for hours. You know, that's okay. All right. But the idea is that that sensory stimulus goes to an interneuron. That interneuron then goes to a motor neuron. And that motor neuron are gap junctions in that connection, right? So it's pretty amazing. That's why that's so fast. But changes here in that habituation that we've talked about in those synapses. All right. And people have even looked at the, you think this is weird, right? The inside of the lobster or crayfish in the mouth, in the region, there's these radula that move back and forth and how to control that. They've actually got imaging of these muscles in the lobster. The chair of Brandeis University in Boston, Eden Martyr, worked on this for many years, but they can actually see how those muscles are coordinated. And there's the somatogastric ganglion. A lot of research is going on the somatogastric ganglion to control the coordination of those muscles. Now, why would anybody be interested in coordination of these muscles that have to work just right for eating? You think, well, that's silly. Why would you do that in a lobster? You know, we just want to eat lobsters, right? We don't want to worry about how they're eating. But it was the fundamentals of patterns and working out locomotion. And then you could build prosthetics from it. So they actually have computational programs of all the neurons that innervate these muscles. And you can actually work on a computer program and how a modulator works. A little bit of serotonin on it jacks the whole system up. But it's still coordinated. It's kind of like you. You know, you get excited, caffeine or epinephrine, or you're going to run faster. You've got to keep that coordination, right? You're not going to move one leg faster than the other one. How does all that work? So they actually did that in a somatogastric ganglion, so it's a big input of understanding prosthetics and robotics in our system, advanced systems. The bird brain is an amazing system, because when I was an undergraduate, you know, everybody said the nervous system didn't regenerate. It's always set right there. There's no new neurons born or anything like that. The only neurons people knew about were the nasal neurons, the olfactory that could turn over and talk about those stem cells. But then people started working on the bird brain, particularly birds that sing in the spring, right, like canaries and zebrafinch, and they actually found out their brain changed sizes during the spring. It changes size. What? How does that happen? And different regions inside the bird brain. So they actually found out that during the spring, when they're starting to singing and mating, and you can relate, well, that's related with hormones, right? Testosterone and estrogen, that some neurons would actually divide and increase their number of neurons. But not only that, where they would project to, they could go to the right projection. And then those target cells would increase in the number of cells also. That's an amazing thing, because that would happen every spring. And then they would regress. And then they would regrow again the next spring. Wow, if you could understand that, then maybe you could understand people with neurological problems, right? To take out some cells, or maybe you could replace those. What's going on? So I don't want you to memorize all the circuitry here, but the idea is that this circuitry, new neurons are born and actually integrate in that circuitry, and even the target neurons would increase in their numbers. And they found out, the main point is that they found out this is hormonally dependent. So, as we'll learn in the endocrine chapter, estrogen is a precursor to testosterone, and then it's actually very important that they have the estradiol and that it would turn into testosterone for the males so they could actually develop those neuronal structures in their brain. So it's under hormonal control, which means, too, how does that control it from the spring, right? So the spring weather, the temperature change, how does that change your endocrine system to then change your nervous system to then change your behavior for singing? So there's just so much in there. It's really quite amazing. You might have heard of some studies where they were looking with frogs and the sounds that frogs make, you know, like burp, 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 right, in the springtime. And then the males are making these sounds and the females, you know, trying to find them. Or the females making the sound, depends on the frogs making the sound, the male has to try to find them. Well, if you cool some of those, let's say the females down, their sound is different, right? And the males won't respond to that if they're at that temperature that they were first at. But if you cool the male down too, now they'll respond to the female's call. So both the nervous systems had to go down or up together, and in the temperature
for the firing frequency to relate to each other. Pretty amazing. So it wasn't just the sound. It has to be the receiver, too, that has to be coordinated with it. I think I've mentioned about before moths that can fly, right, flying around. But some moths that hear the bat echolation, they'll automatically just pull their wings together and do a dive. And you can just give them that sound with a speaker, and they'll do the same thing. So somehow they have this innate behavior to do it, because they're not going to learn that, right? Because they're going to be history if they don't do it the first time. Right? So this is in many textbooks, and this relates to human behavior as well. Just want to show a little bit about this. Voles and mice. So they looked at these different types of voles, prairie voles and montane voles. And hopefully, maybe cover this in ecology? No? Yes? Purge it all? Yes, I know. Years ago. But there's differences in the grooming behavior between these types of voles. Okay, so differences in the grooming behavior. People want to know why are there differences in the grooming behavior. What could be so different about them? Well, they found out that if you had arginine vasopressin and you injected it into the montane bull, it didn't really change its grooming behavior. You inject it in the prairie bull, and you would get a big difference. So that's pretty neat to think about. And this is behavior, you know, cuddling each other, basically. But then they went and found out and said, well, is it really the arginine vasopressin itself? So let's take some mice, and let's inject them with arginine vasopressin controls, and then the ones injected. They didn't show any behavioral differences. But if they increase the receptor expression level, the receptors now, not the hormone, but the receptors to it, and put that in a transgenic mouse and inject arginine vasopressin, it would now increase its grooming behavior. That's pretty amazing. So you begin to think about humans, their affiliation with grooming behavior, social differences, or maybe a mother with a child, things like this. So you can get the idea that this is important to try to understand maybe behavioral differences. Maybe there's a receptor mutation, right? Or maybe there's this autoimmune problem that went on. Maybe it kills out those receptors. Who knows? Lots of different things. So let's just go through a little bit of some of the central nervous system in the higher animals and some of the take-home points that we should remember. In us, our higher vertebrates, we have two different kinds of nervous systems that we should refer to, the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. There's a little gray area in there, sometimes people are confused. But let's make sure we get this straight. If we talk about the sensory system, we know external stimuli, sensory protection is CNS. The output, right, motor neurons, we have motor neurons that go to the somatic. Why is that called somatic? Because it's from somites in development, those muscles that we talked about regionally. And those then, your skeletal muscles and motor neurons. And then you have the autonomic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system means auto, you don't have to think about it, right? And then that's divided into two groups, the sympathetic and parasympathetic, which I'm sure you've heard of, you know, fight or flight before, and understanding the sympathetic. Sometimes you'll see in some textbooks, particularly in the European system, you might hear of a metasympathetic system. So just in case you ever hear of that, metasympathetic system. And that's usually just to the GI tract. Okay. So really quite neat, if you look at this from frogs to humans, how does this segmental system all come together? And you see the sympathetic chain ganglion. These are not dorsal root ganglion. Here's your dorsal root ganglion, these little things here. And this is your sympathetic chain ganglion that runs outside your spinal cord, but around all the way up your region there. And we'll go into a little bit more depth about it. You have brain, the cervical region, thoracic, lumbar, sacral. I don't want you to have to memorize how many segments, but the general points here. Okay, so if we look at that, we have a segmental body, like we mentioned. And then even down the midline as well, which is pretty neat. So everybody knows these innervations. There used to be people that had, like, couldn't feel in the finger. I think I mentioned that before. Like, half their finger they could feel, but the other half they couldn't. They used to think they were possessed by evil spirits or something, or even that zebra banding pattern. They thought they were like witches and things, crazy stuff, but now you know that that's not true, right? So, interesting. Understanding the anatomy is important. And here's that sympathetic chain ganglion outside. There's the dorsal root ganglion, your spinal vertebrae. Okay, and where does all this fit? Here's that sympathetic ganglion outside again, dorsal root ganglion. So, neurons come out of here.
can come into here, innervate, go on to a second order neuron, right, and then out to the target. All right, so we'll cover a little bit more of that. The cranial nerves, lower animals, doesn't matter if it's a snake, an amphibian, or you, we have these 12 cranial nerves, and they go to different regions. Just know there's 12 cranial nerves. You don't have to know which ones do what, but on some exams, standardized exams, you might have to memorize that. So depends on what kind of test you're taking later on. Okay, but the point here is, too, you see those regions of the brain, the color coding? You see those same regions throughout the animal kingdom. As you get to more advanced animals, here's a fish. You can imagine the olfaction, pretty good. It also has some cerebellum for coordination, like we showed you in the lab. The brainstem is the same in all these animals, vertebrates, all the way up to us, in the location in the where these neurons are in the brainstem. And you go into the frog, same kind of idea, a little bit smarter, a bigger cerebrum. Then you get into the bird, right? Lots of different things. But look at the cerebellum, quite developed. That's for coordination, right? Coordination. And the same cranial nerves, the same regions in the spinal cord, and in the brainstem, and the pituitary that we'll talk a lot more about later. And then you get to us, and you see the bigger cerebrum and the cerebellum in the brainstem. Now, the cerebellum is really quite interesting because there's neurons in the cerebellum that are called Purkinje cells, and they have a planar arrangement, like my hand, like that, and they got these long projections. And if you go back to the critical period, it was really important. Anybody remember way back, it's a generation gap, but you can look it up, Ceausescu, that was the dictator in, Romania? And it was horrible. I remember seeing this on the news, where the public finally got upset, and they shot him and his wife right there, and they just showed him dead on the street, right on the street corner. Well, he was kind of a bad dictator, and he actually had baby farms. And he was raising babies, you know, certain kind of eugenics, basically. And he had all these baby farms without the babies having any nurturing. So, did I tell you about that already? No? Okay. And so these babies, some of them died, and then they saved these babies in their brains. And people looked at the brains, and they looked in the cerebellum region, and they found out those neurons called Purkinje cells, that normally you have this nice cell with dendrites and little spines that come off of it, and those little spines are where input would come in. But those babies that didn't get the activity, they didn't have the spines. They were really depressed in the spines. And so the neurologist said, well, look, if they didn't get this input or nurturing or things to play with because they were just put in the baby cribs and not taken care of, they didn't develop the spine coordination in their cerebellum. Well, the comparative biologist or neurobiologist said, we've known about that for years ago because we did that with monkey experiments, for example. And if you don't have things to play with, you don't develop those circuits. It's kind of like that critical period that we just talked about. But this is why you have mobiles above your baby's crib, right? And you talk to them and you interact with them because those neural circuits are being born. The critical period is not just for the visual system. It's also for your motor cortex. It's also for auditory and speech, all different kinds of things, and sensory input as well. So the more sensory input you can give into a developing nervous system, the better it is to make these synapses. And so people have found out the critical period for vision, the critical period for hearing, and then how they coordinate. Like when you hear a sound, if you rotate, if those aren't connected, you have abnormal perception, right? So it's really quite neat. So anyways, the cerebellum, again, for coordination, like we mentioned, and the different parts of the brain. This is just kind of seeing that these parts also relate. The main points I want you to think about are these two right here. This primary sensory and motor. So motor, pink, and sensory here. That you have this arrangement on your brain. And if we look at the structure of the motor, and you look at the sensory, this is the same on both. It's just dividing sensory and motor. So sensory and motor, right? Sensory blue, motor red. And it's the same on the other side, but you can look at it. We have this structure of our body on there. This is called the homunculus, the body structure that's on the brain. So you can touch that part, stimulate that part right here, and somebody's going to say, oh, you're like in my pharynx. You stimulate up here, and somebody's in that part of the brain, and they're going to say, you're touching my face. But you're not touching your face, right? So they got the Nobel Prize for mapping this out. The guy that started a lot of this mapping was actually a guy that worked in the during World War II in France with people that had shrapnel in their brain. and then he was Canadian, and then he was pulling the shrapnel out, and people were saying, oh, you're touching my foot, but he wasn't touching their foot. And then he went back and mapped out when they were doing surgeries in humans, for example, they would do a little electrical stimulation on the brain, and they could actually say, you're touching my toe, you're touching my leg. And that's how they mapped this out in humans.
What'd you say that was called?
Homunculus? Mm-hmm. Like the structure of the body on the... And your sensories is really quite enhanced, right? And we talked about the motor being very enhanced to the face. Why do you think we have so much motor to your face? Kind of related to this whole chapter. Sad, happy, right? Facial expressions. When we talked about that baby, remember? You know, you smile to the baby, you can be saying whatever you want to it, but as long as you're smiling, the baby has a response back. It's kind of this innate behavior you have with visual responses, but coordination of your facial expressions is very important in understanding that relationship throughout primates. So sensory, also very sensitive to the face region. Okay, so you can think of different animals, their homunculus, kind of neat to think about. Think about the snar-nosed mole, basically, and you look at the projections of those structures that lives underground, digs, and you look at its brain, it's really developed for these sensory structures. Let's go through. One last part about this fight or flight, and then we're going to stop and talk about it a little bit. Fight or flight. This is not in the textbook, but it has appeared in standardized exams, so that's why I want to pull this up. Okay, it's called this GAS, or General Adaptation Syndrome. So, if you are stressed out, like exams all the time, right? What does that do to you? It stresses you out, gives you problems, GI problems maybe, stress, you're all tired, you're fatigued, but then the exam's over and you're okay again. But what if you're constantly stressed? Right? Like being in college, constantly stressed, right? And that can actually be very negative. But a little bit of stress is good, right? Might make you perform better. But if it's constant, it can actually wear you down. And this is a big thing that people have looked at, like in zoo animals, for example. So, beginning, there's three phases to this, and this has appeared on standardized exams, that's why I bring it up. Alarm, mobilization, right? Maybe mobilize glucose. Maybe be ready to figure out what might be the stressor. Maybe have to fight or flight, right? You know, whatever you might have to do. But if it's constant all the time, and you have high steroids like cortisol to mobilize that glucose, what's that going to do to your glucose stores in time? Run them down, right? And then you don't have the energy. And then you feel fatigued. And that constant high cortisol can actually depress you and actually wear tissue down. It can actually degrade muscle in time, too. So that's not good. So negative consequences, that's that exhaustion stage. All right. So the sympathetic and parasympathetic system in us, and it goes all the way down to, you know, fish and actually invertebrates. Actually, most of the really interesting work on the autonomic nervous system in lower animals, like in the moth I told you about that folds its wings over, invertebrates have to respond to predators, right? And they have to have a response. How do they do that? That's how you function with your autonomic nervous system. But actually, it was very early, the Germans and Russians really looked at this on a comparative aspect, and they were the leaders in looking at understanding comparative aspects of an autonomic nervous system, how far it went down in the animal kingdom to understand. They actually looked it out in insects. So it's pretty neat. So what's the take home here with the parasympathetic and sympathetic? Fight or flight, right? What would you do if you're scared? What would you do if you're relaxed? How to think about this. And then we'll stop and do a little quiz or something. I was going to do some drawings, but we'll do this quiz instead. So maybe something to remember. If you're walking in the woods, you're going to go up to Appalachia and you have a little cabin up there, right? You're walking in the woods. It's getting dark. Uh-oh, the sun went down. Now it's dark. Don't have your flashlight. You're trying to get to your cabin. And it's really dark. And all of a sudden you hear the stick break behind you. What happens? Uh-oh. You know, fear, right? What would you do? Glucose mobilization. You're getting ready to run. You're attentive with hearing, right? And then you look at it and you find out, uh-oh, it's a bear, right? It's a black bear. But then fortunately you realized, oh, I have my bear gun with me. And you turn around and you shot it, right? And you dragged it up to your cabin. And then you realize your significant other is already up at the cabin. So that's kind of neat. And now you're going to cook a bear steak.
in case you're not vegetarian. And then there's a hot tub up there. You got electricity, right? And you got a hot tub. You're going to relax. And now you're going to sit in this bathtub and have a nice steak. And if you're over 21, you're going to pop the wine bottle, right? And then you're going to have a little bit of wine and relax. And then you start to think about what you're going to be doing with your significant other, right? So, okay. So that's the sympathetic initially, and that's the parasympathetic later, okay? So that could help you think about things and blood flow to different regions, like skeletal muscle or reproductive organs. So that's the way to remember, I think, the sympathetic and parasympathetic system and how it all works together. And this is what happens with you. Okay, so you can go through this table and generally kind of pick out some main points, but you know, it's not so hard. I'm not going to test on little nitty gritties, but the general points on this sympathetic and parasympathetic system. Okay, and what's kind of neat about it, though, right before we stop, is that if you look at the innervation from the sympathetic and parasympathetic division, now this is important too because it's on standardized exams. So this is your neuron and your spinal cord, or your going out to, say, a ganglion in the sympathetic chain ganglion. Acetylcholine. Parasympathetic. From the nervous systems, you know, central nervous system out, acetylcholine. So they both have acetylcholine. But now, what's the target transmitter? Well, parasympathetic acetylcholine. Ooh, I remember this pair. How about parasympathetic? Acetylcholine, acetylcholine. Way to remember. Sympathetic, acetylcholine and epinephrine. All right, so that way you'll know it's different. And then if we look at the innervation from the parasympathetic and sympathetic, generally, the sympathetic is thoracic lumbar. Parasympathetic is cranial sacral. Cranial sacral. A pair, again, cranial sacral, right? A pair. So you can remember pair, acetylcholine, acetylcholine, cranial sacral, sympathetic thoracic lumbar, acetylcholine, norepinephrine, or epinephrine. Okay, so try to remember that. You can see the general patterns. And these are the receptors that we talked about, cholinergic receptors. But the preganglionic, that first synapse, they're both nicotinic, like your skeletal muscles. Why is this important again? If you're taking standardized exams, this might appear on that. So the pre-neuron to the post-ganglionic are nicotinic. And you'll see those on old pre-check exams too, right? And then the target, the postganglionic neuron to the target tissue, this is where it gets a little confusing. The acetylcholine receptors, remember the pair, it's not nicotinic. They're muscarinic. Remember, muscarinic are not ion channels. They work through a second messenger cascade system on the target system. So the target of these parasympathetic, the second target, are muscarinic receptors. Then the target for the epinephrine and norepinephrine, they're alpha or beta adrenergic receptors. We'll get into a little bit more of that, but that was very confusing to people early on because if you activate an alpha, that could cause vasoconstriction. If you activate a beta, that could cause vasodilation. It depends where target you're talking about, right? So this is why the pharmacology is very interesting. So let's pause, do a quiz, not too hard, multiple choice on some, but let's separate out, kind of move around, get some space. Thank you.